Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of January. Happy New Year to all of you. On Earth Magazine has an interesting December issue. Redrawing the American City is one of the articles, and it focuses on how to recycle our environment and use underused rail lines, neglected apartment houses, and office structures. The author explores Chicago, the city and the suburbs, the commuter towns that are just outside the city of Chicago, and the central city itself. She finds communities and neighborhoods that are building in, not out, giving new life to disconnected subdivisions and redefining downtown. And I guess that's what we'll call this hour, redefining downtown. These are ideas that are sprouting up and being put into practice in cities all over the country, including Milwaukee, Aurora, Illinois. Our guest is Henry Henderson. He's director of the National Resource Defense Council's Midwest Program, which opened an office in the city of Chicago in 2007. Before that, he worked as a partner in a Chicago-based environmental consulting firm and was the founding commissioner for the city of Chicago's Department of Environment from 1992 to 1998. In that position, he developed an environmental mission for the city, which included the development of the Chicago Brownfield Initiative, a natural resources rehabilitation initiative, the city's energy policies, and economic development. He also served as Illinois Assistant Attorney General from 85 to 87 and has taught environmental law and policy at the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois, and Kent College of Law. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Henry. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you'd care to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Henry. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah. Chicago really has become this model. Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration behind the green buildings, the development, and let's start with the central city here. How did that all get rolling?
Well, I think that it's part of the DNA of Chicago to redefine itself repeatedly, and to look at assets like its face onto the Great Lakes, the fact that there is an opportunity for huge improvement of quality of life and the economy of the city through leveraging the assets of the environment, and the current pressure in the city comes a lot from the mayor's office. Mm. The mayor sees himself as basically a pioneer in how you improve quality of life by engaging the ecology of the city.
Mm-hmm. The author of this piece in On Earth talked about going up an elevator building and looking out the 11th floor from the roof of that building and seeing all these green patches of flowers and gardens and grass on buildings all over Chicago.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting thing. When I was Commissioner of Environment, I went on a trip with the mayor to Hamburg, Germany, and that's where he first saw green roofs and was very interested in that and said, what actually is this about? And the fact that you had demonstrable reduction of energy demand, the fact that it dealt with water within a dense urban environment more effectively, and took pressure away from already overtaxed sewer systems, was something that really lit a fire in his imagination. And coming back from that trip, he said, I want a green roof initiative beginning with City Hall. Huh. So that's how that came about. And it was like taking ideas, learning from other places, and applying them to the environment of the dense urban environment of Chicago.
And why do you get a demonstrable reduction of energy demand from a green roof?
Well, that's really at the heart of a lot of what we need to be doing in terms of redefining our cities. We've got to not just have interesting aesthetic ideas, we've got to be able to have measurable results. And the first serious green roof in Chicago was on City Hall, which is a large building in the center of the city that half the block is City Hall, half the block is the county building. City Hall, side did the green roof. The county side did not. And then you've got a series of very, very obvious measurements in terms of what the heat is on the roof in the middle of the summer. It's, you know, up to 50 degrees less on the green roof side.
Ooh.
That translates into significant reduction of energy demand within the side that has the green roof, obviously, because you don't need as much cooling. It also results in, when you have large rainstorms, the green roof absorbs and holds the rain, rather than reducing it immediately into the sewer system and thus adding to already clogged and overused sewers. So you've got a range of measurable goals, and you put those in place when you make this investment.
So does the county now have a green roof?
No.
No? Why not?
You know, the nature of public decision-making is extraordinarily difficult, and I think that's one of the things this article in On Earth is trying to get at, is that there are built incentives that can either drive investment in things that work better or continue to hunker down on things that don't perform. And that's one of the things we have as an example of this split in the green roof, non-green roof on City Hall, is that you've got very different incentives about what people will invest in, and we've got to move toward more progressive investment. That's part of our goal.
Is this a fairly inexpensive way to hold on energy, or is it expensive to make roofs green?
There is a more expense on the front end in terms of the capital investment, but in terms of the performance over the life of the investment, it definitely pays off. And depending on the size of the roof, how elaborate you want to get with the roof, et cetera, you can pay off in a less than five year investment time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in both in terms of maintenance costs and the issues of reduction of energy demand.
Now, I know you're doing some work outside the city of Chicago. Some is being done in Aurora and also in Milwaukee. Is that green roof work, or does it go beyond that, Henry?
Well, it's in Aurora, it goes well beyond that, in that you've got a large portion of the city, which Aurora is a really lovely 19th century river city. That has the Fox River running right through it, and it's sort of like it's an interesting thing from looking from the Milwaukee perspective, is that the top of the Fox River is runs through Waukesha, and so Aurora is part of that continuum from Waukesha, and there are lessons from Aurora that can be clearly applied to Waukesha and the Milwaukee area in terms of water conservation, rediscovery of the value of the river's edge, and how you get a cleanup of the legacy sites along the river's edge so that you rediscover the asset that the river is. And by tying it back into the city itself through green infrastructure, that you bring the city much more into relationship with its natural resources. And I think that has a range of social benefits as well.
And what do you mean by green infrastructure?
Well, it's a lot of what our cities do is they try to mimic natural processes with concrete and pipes. And there's a whole natural structure of water going into the ground, recharging aquifers, adding to the flow of the river, et cetera, creating a series of values. How we have built our cities often takes these resources and puts them into concrete and gets them out of the region, out of the environment very quickly in a way that depletes aquifers and causes us greater shortages of water, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the green infrastructure approach is, how do you take natural processes like open space, like then creating new open space on green roofs, how you look at uh, this, the cityscape and the walkways and parks, and use them as open space to receive rainwater and stormwater, hold it, recharge your groundwater with it, and use these natural processes to manage water as a resource as opposed to a waste issue.
Hmm. The article made mention, and this is kind of far from Chicago. I don't know if any people use Metro to work in the city from, what's the name of the place? Prairie Crossing.
Prairie Crossing, yes, they do, in fact.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Huh. So here's a community that was designed with exactly what you had, what you just mentioned in mind.
Correct. And it's a classic example of new urbanism in that you had a development where there was a demand for development. And instead of building a series of cookie cutter bedroom community, what was done was taking looking at the land and the property and saying, how do we leverage this large amount of very, very beautiful land with wetlands and woods upon it and keep those attributes and accommodate the same number of people that that would be in a sort of a traditional 1950s development. That was done, and what you have is a very lovely community with lots of wetland, open space, habitat retained that add to the quality of life of the people who live there, walkability, bikeability, and just the amenities of being in nature and in the country.
Mm-hmm. And can you convert? I grew up in the Chicago suburbs. My parents started in the city, and uh-huh. then they went to Des Plaines, and then they went to Elk Grove Village. So
sure.
it was this.
There used
movement.
To be a grove there, apparently.
Yeah, there used to be a lot of cornfields there. Not anymore. It's been a long, long time. Is there? And I'm thinking about the massive population that lives in that area now,
yeah.
in all of those communities. Can there be? Is there any kind of movement? Let's look at the whole for a second. Is there a movement to move those people who have gone way out to the suburbs and beyond back into the city, or is the movement also to take some of those suburbs and make them more like Prairie Crossing?
It's hard to take an already heavily built environment and completely change it. But it is one of the great frontiers of how you bring smart design, smart growth, green design to bear in the already built environment. It's been, oddly enough, easier in a dense city like Chicago, where there have been real opportunities to open up areas, to reestablish natural plant regimes, that type of thing. Aurora is a good example of it as well, where you've got a very, very dense environment that is... now has become the second largest city in Chicago, in Illinois, and is one of the fastest growing cities in the country.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And it is an old 19th century city with a sprawl around the edges of 70s 80s suburban growth. So where do you accommodate people? How do you do that? Well, it's looking back at the urban core in the area that is the legacy of the 19th century that allows a repurposing, rebuilding, and reestablishment of the old built environment. And that's the kind of thing where there were things on NPR this morning about green jobs. Mm-hmm. Part of what is an opportunity for doing well and doing good at the same time, creating jobs that actually add to the quality of life and improve the environment, is the whole retrofitting of the already built environment,
mm-hmm.
so that you make it more energy efficient, you make it more attractive. There's more natural. You redo the roofs, like we're talking about with green roofs. You redo the insulation and the wiring systems within the buildings, make them much more energy efficient. And while doing that, you're creating good, solid jobs in many different trades. So the thing is that we keep saying about retrofitting the already built environment for greater energy efficiency. you're not going to take the urban core and move it to China to get retrofitted and then move back. You're creating jobs in our community. Those are the kind of green jobs we're talking about that pay back, improve quality of life, and generate value within the community itself.
And how many of those jobs are being generated now, Henry?
Well, there are. It depends on where the resource where resources and the inducements are. For instance, in you can look at Ohio, which has adopted a very strong energy efficiency portfolio and has moved policies forward where the utilities actually earn money from energy efficiency. It's created much more opportunities for good green-collar jobs on retrofitting the built environment. There are areas where there are sort of perverse incentives that make it more expensive to do energy efficiency, where there is definitely a lag on the creation of those jobs. And there's been a fair amount of work by University of Massachusetts, University of California, Berkeley, on not just the opportunity for these jobs, but where they can happen and documenting how you verify this. So there's a huge opportunity, and what we need to be doing is getting our policy signals right.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Henry, and here's how you can reach our conversation. Smart growth is really what we're talking about this hour. On Earth magazine has a great piece on Chicago, redrawing the city. Chicago's plans could help save the planet from climate change. We're looking at the inspiration for those ideas and how they're being implemented, not only in the city, but in areas surrounding Chicago as well. Some areas that have a lot of poverty. We'll look at some of those and how they're changing, how you link housing for people who don't make a whole lot of money to jobs, how you link them to jobs as well, and the different kinds of growth that are going on in those communities. Henry Henderson is director of the National Resources Defense Council Midwest Program, which opened its office in Chicago in 2007. He also served as a partner in the Chicago-based environmental consulting firm and was a founding commissioner for the City of Chicago's Department of Environment from 92 to 98. So he helped develop an environmental mission for the City of Chicago, some of which you can see implemented right now in terms of using space, Millennium Park on an old railroad track, I believe, and green buildings, green roofs in many Chicago buildings. So smart growth. Join us. Join the conversation. Where else are you seeing this? Do you see a whole lot of promise in this area in terms of job creation and in terms of making our cities really on the cutting edge of taking on the issue of global climate change? We also have an email address. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Henry Henderson is our guest, and once again, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Smart growth is what we're talking about. Before we go to some callers here, Henry, let's talk a little bit about downtown Chicago, because most of our listeners will be familiar with all of the changes that have taken place there. Another thing that we're talking about is converting areas that were, I believe that this park was built on top of an old rail yard. Is that right?
Yeah, it actually was. The land there was reclaimed in the 19th century after the Chicago Fire. That used to be, Michigan Avenue used to be where Lake Michigan ended. And so this was part of the harbor of Chicago, and a lot of the debris from the fire was actually just dumped in there and created this landfill that is Grant Park, mm-hmm. and that was and still is under there. It's a rail yard. So you built Millennium Park on top of that, and you still have commuter rails coming in from the south and in Indiana into the city at that point.
It's a great park, isn't it?
It's just fantastic.
Wonderful.
And you get right in the middle of the city. You get these prairie plants and these groves of trees, and it is a fantastic amenity. And that's part of what we're talking about, is how do you take a legacy of a previous function of the city, of that this is a rail yard where a rail comes in, and it is a point of a particular type of commerce that has completely changed, and do you just simply say, oh, there's nothing we can do about it, we've inherited it, and it's kind of ugly, and let's just live with it, or do you make the investment on a legacy site to leverage new value? That's what we are presented with in so many ways within our region, and so many ways within how we live with the wonderful Great Lakes that we all share. And it's the kind of thing that is in the discussion right now about the Asian carp coming up the canal system and threatening the Great Lakes. Do we look at that legacy from the 19th century and simply accept it, or do we say we can do a lot better and build a new value and get rid of the problem at the same time? So there are a lot of interesting on-the-edge kind of questions that we're confronted with right now, and reinventing the urban core is part of the appropriate response that leverages value for all of us.
So what are we all doing about the Asian carp?
Well, Wisconsin has joined Michigan, New York, et cetera, in asking the Supreme Court to order emergency action, a long-term resolution of the problem by disconnecting the Mississippi from the Great Lakes as had been the case up until 100 years ago. We believe that this is a great opportunity as part of addressing a legacy of past action that had impacts we didn't anticipate. And we think the green infrastructure piece is something that can help reformulate how we live with this problem and actually solve it. I think that you will find the response saying, if we close these canals, we'll have flooding in the city of Chicago. Yes, unless you do a range of things to fix the management of water in a more effective way, and a green infrastructure response is part of the template of actually getting this right. So we've got an opportunity to invest appropriately and fix the problem and come out better on the other end than just sort of hunkering down and saying there's nothing we can do about it.
Let's go to phone calls, starting with David from Kenosha. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I'm a county supervisor here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and we are about to approve our smart growth plan here within the next, I believe, month to month and a half. And I've read through it a number of times, and there is nothing really mentioned at all about environmental sustainability regarding our smart growth. And I've tried to mention it to my colleagues on the board, and they don't seem to feel the importance of it, even though we've lost so many jobs and we have a Chrysler plant that's on the brink of closing. Any advice you got for me?
I'd be very interested to look at your plan. What is implied by smart growth if it doesn't have to do with environmental improvements in addition to other improvements? What's smart about it?
Essentially, how this started from my understanding is, I guess, about one or two governors ago, I think it was under Tommy Thompson, the state legislature said that every municipality had to have a smart growth plan, and there were elements in there, housing, education and employment, natural resources, agriculture, and some other things. And the idea was, of course, to curtail the rampant growth that we had in terms of eating up the land. But, of course, the legislative process left a lot of loopholes in the details as to what specifically had to be included. And I guess you could say, concerning this conversation, it got watered down.
Ho, ho, ho. My understanding is part of that, the inducement was that for that was also looking at water demands within Wisconsin as a whole, and that's part of what the inducement from the state's end was, and how do we as a state, get a better understanding of the management of water, the problem of stormwater, the depletion of aquifers, that type of thing, that remains a large issue in terms of the Great Lakes watershed, non-Great Lakes watershed divide within Wisconsin, and that is part of it, the heart of your smart growth plans. Isn't that right?
It is, and in Kenosha, we have been somewhat proactive in addressing that because we do have a significant portion of our county that is outside of the watershed of Lake Michigan.
Right.
But when you look at policymakers locally and you mention, you know, permeable pavement, they tend to look at you like, what? Why
do
we have
this
that?
This is a really, really important point you're bringing up, is that trying to drive green infrastructure as a central piece of smart growth requires us, who are advocates for this, getting more explicit and to show how these things actually perform, how they cut down on expense, how they have a series of other benefits in terms of driving down the need for supersizing your sewer system. The fact that it has benefits in terms of being able to weather drought more effectively. There are a range of performance metrics that we need to be a lot better at pushing out there. And we've got examples like in Philadelphia, where the city has just adopted a $1.6 billion Green City Clean Waters Plan that deals with stormwater, creates corridors that are a restored green space within the city, and is tied to a series of performance metrics on how it cuts down tax expenses and improves quality of life within particular communities. We need to be bringing that in a site-specific way to areas like Kenosha County, where you've got definite pressures between the Great Lakes watershed communities and those that aren't. So there's a real need to show how it works, and I think that is something that falls within our to-do list more effectively.
Thanks, David, so much for the call. Let's go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just had a quick question. Looking ahead towards environmentally sustainable and conscious growth in the 21st century, I'm curious to hear Chicago's perspective as to why there isn't, you know, as to the issue about severing the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which, you know, is draining the Great Lakes and is, you know, potentially bringing Asiatic carp from the Mississippi River system to the Great Lakes system. I know there are several states, including Wisconsin, who have signed on to a lawsuit against the state of Illinois to force its closure. And I guess I'd like to hear an environmental sustainable growth perspective from somebody from Illinois and the Chicago area, specifically on that closure and why there isn't more political will in Illinois to do that.
That's a very good question about the nature of the political will. I think there is that the Chicago diversion has been subject to about a century of litigation. Both people on the receiving end of the waste, it was in the early 19th century, and currently the Great Lakes community being concerned about draining of water from the basin. The fact is that beyond simply a quantity issue, the Chicago diversion, like many other interventions into the Great Lakes, have become highways for invasive species that are changing the ecology of what is 20% of the world's fresh water. We need to fix that. This is a legacy we've inherited that has become highly dysfunctional and dangerous to the well-being and sustainability of our community within the Great Lakes. So we believe that the lawsuit that was initiated 2 weeks ago by Michigan and now has been joined by the other Great Lakes states and Ontario as of today, I believe, articulates a need to fix this legacy and reestablish the boundaries that protect the Great Lakes from further invasions. So one of the problems is not just the legacy of the built problem, but also the mentality that somehow we inherited this way of doing business, and therefore we have to forever be bound by that way of doing business. And what I would like to see from the Illinois side is that the state of Illinois would appear before the Supreme Court this Friday, when it will be up, and to say, we agree that a solution needs to be found. We want to, we would sign on to the following process of this kind of review about how reestablishing the barriers could work in a way that is consistent with the movement of goods and the management of water within the greater Chicago region, and to engage in a fulsome discussion on how that can be done in the most cost-effective, quickest way that provides the longest-term solution. This needs to be fixed. The continued draining of water and the continued highway for invasives is long-term, short-term, and mid-term kind of insanity.
Thank you very much, John, for your call. We go to Tony, who's in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Tony.
Hello, all. I'm actually visiting Madison, my old hometown, as of April this year. I've moved to New York, but stayed in touch.
I guess.
So thank you for the online radio.
Sure.
And one thing that I wanted to mention that I really, really enjoyed on the East Coast that I never had here was commuter rail. And I don't know how much the guests might want to get into it, but I think as part of a future-forward green initiative of any sort, you need to figure out how to make I-94 be a non-exclusive way to get between Milwaukee, Madison, and towns in between. And it seems like, going back a long time, you have to go back to the 50s to a point where we actually had commuter rail. And it's been, I think it's been sorely missed, and I don't think enough people are perhaps upset enough at that to maybe change it quickly. But I'm curious what might be happening, if anything, to maybe reinstate this or repurpose some rail.
Yeah, I think that as part of a sustainable urban network, looking at just what you're talking about in terms of commuter rail is critically important. And we have within, in the Midwest, there was a very aggressive push in the 19th century on rail, a lot of which we continue to have railways, et cetera, that are not functioning as well in terms of a transportation system, both people and commerce, that that we could hope for. So I think there's a real effort and a real real focus, particularly in the in environmental and part of the business community, on a business transportation bill that will come out of the next transportation bill in Congress that starts to prioritize just the kind of things you're talking about. I personally am blessed with living on a commuter rail line that gets me to and from work on an incredibly pleasant way every morning, and it's the kind of thing that could be expanded much more effectively within our region. Actually, the thing I write on goes all the way to Kenosha. So there is a backbone that needs to be built and expanded beyond. I also think going back to this question of the Chicago Canal and the Asian Carp. One of the things that's been striking is how the discussion about the importance of keeping the canal open for the movement of goods doesn't integrate the canal system and the movement of things on waterways into an integrated transportation vision that includes rail and includes intermodal facilities that could actually improve the efficiency of the movement of goods as opposed to looking at these things in just a piecemeal, divided, unintegrated way. So we've got an opportunity to integrate the movement of people and goods much more effectively in a way that will pay off to the economy, but also a quality of life.
Let's spend a little more time on commuting, because this article we were mentioning also deals with West Garfield Park and Blue Island. Mm-hmm. And when you look at revitalization of both of those areas, closer to Chicago than Prairie Crossing, the the lines, the transportation lines that take people into the city are crucial, aren't they, in terms of finding jobs and in terms of all of that, and in terms of attracting businesses to some of the blighted areas in those communities.
Absolutely, and it goes into the sort of economics of our cities and the economics of social equity, where so much of the impediment to people who need jobs finding jobs is dislocation between where they live and where they need to work. You get people who have multi-hour commutes on disconnected public transportation systems and cannot afford to simply drive to work and are dependent upon public transportation. Part of a working city needs to integrate how people live and how they get to work in a way that is much more economically sustainable. And I think that's one of the things that is really well discussed and displayed in this article on Earth. We've done a lot of work at NRDC on the whole thing of location-efficient mortgages, for instance, and when people are looking at getting loans for their homes, for where they live, looking at the transportation costs that they have to bear is part of the evaluation of how they can pay and service the debt they're taking. And it is completely not looked at in the traditional way of analyzing how you invest and lend to housing stock in our cities. And that needs to be taken into account and integrated into how you build a commuter system.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Henry Henderson. He's director of the Midwest Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And we are talking about smart growth this hour. On Earth Magazine features the city of Chicago and several other communities in terms of, well, Chicago's done a lot in terms of smart growth. And it looks at Blue Island, West Garfield Park, and Prairie Crossing. Those communities, but our guest is also doing work in the cities of Milwaukee and Aurora and has, as you can hear from his comments, a very good grasp of what's going on in the Midwest when it comes to smart growth. A couple lines are open for you. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have an email that's come in, Henry, from Karen in Madison. How much retrofitting needs to be done to a traditionally built building in order to support the weight of the water and soil required for a productive green roof?
Well, I think that it's one of the upfront engineering analyses you've got to do when you're going to put a green roof on. I know the city of Chicago, the city hall. It could stand a fair amount of mulch and other soil material on the top of it because it was built 1911 where they tended to over-engineer and overbuild, and it was something that could be done with a great deal of different opportunities. But there's a whole range of different green roof technologies that are possible. Very thin membrane with a very that can go on less robust buildings and basically act very similar to a traditional roof. So you can, it's not a one size fits all. It's very much a how do you build it for the particular structure. So there's a great deal of variability there. In addition to which, there's a great deal of variability in terms of what kind of performance you want to get out of it. Is it essentially to insulate? Is it essentially to deal with the increased management of water? So you can design it for a number of different outcomes that's very attentive to the nature of the building itself.
We go now to Ernest from Hayward. Hi, Ernest.
Hi. A timely topic. I was just at a public hearing on comprehensive planning last night, One problem I have with comprehensive planning is it seems to only recognize regulation, zoning, and acquiring of funding from state and federal levels, and it doesn't recognize a proper pricing in the economy and the environment. For example, urban sprawl could be curbed and green building could be encouraged by property tax reform that would shift taxes from buildings to the land. You wouldn't be penalized for building green. You could acquire infill cheaper because nobody would want to hold on to it for speculative purposes.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly good insight, and it is just that kind of approach that needs to be brought to this discussion, is that these are not simple linear questions. There are multiple different interrelated systems, from tax to zoning, et cetera, in terms of the inducements. So I think you're exactly right about that. How do you bring that to bear to the public realm where that kind of intelligent advocacy is needed?
Well, this was mandated by the state of Wisconsin, and it has lists several elements, but none of the elements include this idea of tax reform. It doesn't seem to recognize the market forces.
Yeah, the market forces are absolutely critical here, and this is not going to be done and achieved simply by regulatory fiat. There have to be an unleashing of market forces in order to achieve these benefits. There are, exactly what you're saying, perverse incentives that drive against doing the appropriate thing from an economic point of view. And this is one of the things we're looking at in Milwaukee, where you have, for instance, the way you price water is, in fact, essential to paying off the bonds for managing the water system. So there's an incentive within the way water is paid for in Milwaukee to drive more and more use as opposed to drive conservation.
Hmm.
So the question is, how do you make it possible that actual conservation of water, efficiency in water, which is actually mandated by the new Great Lakes Compact, how does that get brought into Great Lakes water utilities like Milwaukee, like Chicago, which price for greater and greater use as opposed to greater and greater efficiency? So if we don't decouple some of these perverse incentives, the market is not going to deliver the benefits that that can be brought if we get our pricing right.
So what's the alternate vision then? It's not greater and greater use, it's what?
It's a greater and greater water service. For instance, if you are and you're finding this on the other side of the water system in Milwaukee with the sanitary district, and Kevin Schaefer and his team have been very aggressive at how do you conserve and lessen the amount of water going into the sewer system. So they're very attentive to the need for, quote, conserving, end quote, the water that is being used in their system that can have a series of benefits. So their 2010 budget has put $5 million for a green roof program that will reduce the amount of water that goes into the system and then needs to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways in which you're looking at delivering a broader palette of services than simply a per volume amount that that in fact you the more you use, the less you pay.
Right. But it obviously would have to be a much larger program than the amount of money that you just described, right?
Oh, absolutely. But the Metropolitan Sanitary District in Milwaukee has been really pushing on how to do things like this Green Seams program, which is protecting 1,800 acres of land by acquisition and keeping that open and a way to get to get water back into the aquifer. They're investing in porous pavement, rain gardens, in addition to the Green Roofs program. So looking at this in a comprehensive way to significantly reduce the amount of gallons of water that become sewage. And then they're tying that into an interesting thing, which I think is at the heart of integrating green design, which is how, by reducing the amount of sewage and water that goes into the sewage system, how do they reduce the energy costs? Because the less you have to treat, the less energy you need to use, and that translates into specific savings for the utility. And so these are the kinds of things that they're wrapping together and putting into metrics that can actually help us expand the program more effectively.
Thanks very much for the call. We go to our next caller. Hi, you're on the air. What is your first name?
Bill.
Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Will. Hi, Will. Go ahead.
This is really an important issue. I was raised out west, and until I came up to this part of the country, I didn't realize how much water there was on this continent. But we have a real problem, not with so much as a lack of water, but it's basically neglect. We need to start treating not only water coming out of the cities and do that more efficiently. The green roof thing is wonderful. I've seen that out west, and it's great, especially in a hot, dry climate. But we there's a national water blog. It's called WaterWired. If you Google it, you can see the ongoing, not only international, but national questions in relation to the water issues. We really need a comprehensive plan, not only of producing energy from water, where we can have hydroelectric, small, like microhydro dams. Giant dams don't work. They're a real problem. We need thousands and thousands of constructed wetlands to mitigate the destruction of the water going into the Gulf of Mexico.
Absolutely.
Chesapeake Bay, all those kinds of things. It's just incredible. We can produce so much electricity, treat the water so it's clean. We're destroying the oceans. And then we need a bunch of other ones that are just pass-through ponds, like Bill Mollison, the guy who was the founder of permaculture, his plans. We need, I don't know, as many as it takes to do the job and recharge the water tables. The Ogallala Aquifer areas are now below 10 or 15%.
Henry.
He's totally correct. Water scarcity is the one of the largest and most immediate threats to human habitation on Earth. There's no question about it. And in the Midwest, on the edge of the Great Lakes, there's something counterintuitive about it. We have literally 20% of the world's fresh water at our doorstep, and it is an irreplaceable, non-renewable resource that we need to get a handle on how we value and invest in it, so that we are actually appropriate stewards over this amazing inheritance. So, I think the caller is exactly right that a vision on water, a vision on this as an irreplaceable resource at the heart of our very existence, needs to be embraced, renewed, and understood as a way of fixing our institutions.
Thank you, Will, so much for the call. We've had people call and wonder how to get a hold of you. You do a blog, don't you? Is there a website?
Yeah, it's on the NRDC NRDC website, which is www.nrdc.org.
Okay.
And when you do that, there's a whole thing, a blog section you can go into, and my colleagues do a whole lot of blogs as well. And there's a lot. Cade Benfield, who heads our Smart Growth program, he blogs almost every day about these issues, and he's extraordinarily interesting on this. There are a lot of my colleagues who do a huge amount on these broader water questions that Will just mentioned, I would really, really encourage and welcome people to check out our discussions.
It takes in so much, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's what ecology is supposed to be about, is how all these things are interrelated,
right,
as opposed to isolated. And cities are a place of significant interrelation, and therefore are one of the most important and interesting areas of ecology, I think.
And who's done the most? Name the top three cities that have done the most in these areas. Would you include Chicago?
Well, I think Chicago is definitely a leader in the Midwest and has been very engaged and intelligent about it. I think on the water issues, wastewater, I think Milwaukee is doing a really interesting amount of work. I think Philadelphia is approaching this in a very comprehensive way. So there are the cities that aren't usually kind of like identified as, your favorite green location like Portland, et cetera. Mm-hmm. These are important 19th century built environments that are engaging in creating a future that is more sustainable and leveraging value.
Thank you, Henry. Thanks for being with us. Henry Henderson, our guest director of the Midwest Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting hour and John Treader for on-air production in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll be with you tomorrow, Alan Alda, at 9 o'clock.